ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Corbin Middlemass here. The Ashes were awesome, but they are over. The good news is the cricket keeps rolling as the focus shifts to the T20 World Cup. Australia is trying to climb back to the top, India is looking all-powerful, and England is trying to turn Ashes shame into T20 glory. And did we mention the backroom power struggles? The ABC Cricket Podcast is dropping every Monday and Friday as former opener Ed Cowan joins me to pull apart the juiciest storylines in the game. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Please move out of the square.
Everywhere we turn, people are getting pepper sprayed, pushed to the ground, arrested for no reason. It's a peaceful protest. We just want to go home safely.
And they started pushing us with horses with nowhere to go, and everyone was getting squished like sardines.
The protesters came in force. What began peacefully descended into chaos. Around 6,000 people had gathered to condemn the visit to Sydney by the Israeli president. There were violent clashes with police after they were ordered to disperse.
That expression of the popular will of people in this city was met through really sickening state violence by our Premier and our New South Wales police force.
The police did what they needed to do, which was to hold the line and then form and move the protesters back with a view to dispersing them. That was designed to keep the community safe. Having an angry and violent mob marching on police is not a situation that I want our officers in.
And we couldn't have a choose-your-own-adventure situation where protesters and mourners clashed on Sydney streets. That would have been terrible for our state, even worse than the scenes that we saw yesterday evening.
Today, law professor Luke McNamara from the University of New South Wales on the new protest laws brought in after the Bondi attack. And why the Labor government has gone too far. I'm Sam Hawley on Gadigal Land in Sydney. This is ABC News Daily. Luke, you were there at the beginning of the protest in Sydney. So just paint a picture for me. What was that like? What was the crowd like at the time that you were present?
It was a large, peaceful assembly.
Mm-hmm.
One couldn't help but notice that there was a heavy cordon of blue uniform police officers effectively ringing the plaza where people were gathered. But it was exactly the sort of gathering that has been happening for more than 2 years now in Sydney. That is a peaceful gathering of residents of New South Wales expressing their concerns and expressing their political views.
But it did turn ugly. What do you make of what unfolded?
Yeah, I've been thinking about what I've seen of the video and some of the still photography and some of the reports that I've heard. And this may seem strange for a professor of law to lead with, but I felt really sad and disappointed that this was happening in Sydney, in New South Wales.
Well, the Assistant Police Commissioner, Peter McKenna, he does say that those video clips that you refer to that have, of course, been posted online, he says they do not tell the whole story.
Please understand they are small videos being put up, and I would say out of context, of what was a rolling melee of violence and un-Australian and inappropriate behaviour tonight. And it was really disappointing to see.
But some of the clips are pretty concerning, aren't they? Pretty confronting.
Well, they're extremely confronting. I mean, I think, can there be a more peaceful form of expression than kneeling on the pavement and praying, as some men were doing? And to be aggressively, physically disrupted and dragged away by police officers.
One video shared on social media appears to show police hauling away Muslims while they were on the ground praying.
Is there anything more peaceful than a man with his hands up in the air showing I'm doing no harm and being tackled by police officers and repeatedly punched in the body? So I'm not saying that's the sum total of what occurred last night, but the mere fact that those events occurred and that the police were clearly responsible for those acts, that's deeply troubling.
Well, the Greens MP, Abigail Boyd, was there. She said she was actually watching when that group of men who were kneeling to pray were dragged away by police. And she alleges that she was pushed by police and she injured her chin and wrist and needed hospital treatment.
As I'm trying to regain my balance, another police officer punches me in the head, and then I get another one after that that punches me in the shoulder. I don't understand how that is a proportionate response to anything. I was not doing the wrong thing, and nor was anybody around me.
Now, Chris Minns, he has defended police in relation to that moment where these men were praying.
There is no suggestion under any circumstances that police would have wanted to cause offence to the people praying or get in the way of people lawfully exercising their religion. The truth of the matter is New South Wales police have had a strong and cooperative relationship with Sydney's Islamic Arabic community going back decades, but context is important here, and the circumstances facing New South Wales police was incredibly difficult. It was in effect in the middle of a riot.
Well, I would say that Chris Minns would indeed defend the police because it is his government, that has introduced the laws that required the police, on their view, to act as they did. The police had been authorised, had been directed to keep all protesters off walkways and pavements and to not allow them to engage in a procession. So they were the legal settings that were put in place. So it's not surprising that Chris Minns would defend the police implementation of those measures because they were his measures.
Because the protesters, though, just to be clear, they had been banned from marching from Town Hall to the State Parliament, which is about a kilometre away. So police had orders to stop them trying to do that. And the New South Wales Police Commissioner, Mal Lanyon, he says that he believes the organisers of that protest intended to breach that order, intended to breach the law.
Our police showed remarkable restraint. During the first part of the speeches, it was peaceful. We were working continuously with the organiser. However, speakers were inciting the crowd to march.
Well, that's for him to assess. I mean, I have no knowledge or insight about that. I think the actions of the vast majority of protesters would be contrary to that characterisation. I heard nothing in the time that I was there to suggest that we were encouraged to breach the law. On the contrary, I think the organisers had made it quite clear that that wasn't their intention. I think when an assemble group chants, "Let us march," I think that's a legitimate expression of a political view about the outrageous restrictions that have been imposed on the right of peaceful assemblies. Mm-hmm. People expressing their views, expressing their frustration at not being able to do what thousands and thousands of people have done for the last 50 years, that is, make that well-trodden path from Town Hall, the classic gathering place of protesters, through the streets of Sydney.
All right. Well, Luke, I want to consider with you now these changes that we have seen to the protest laws in New South Wales since the Bondi attack. It's good, I think, first to go backwards a bit to get a sense of what the situation was prior to that. Just remind me, what were the rules around protests in Sydney before?
Yeah, I think it is really important to go back in time and indeed to go back perhaps a bit further than you had in mind, because I want to take us back to 1979. When the Public Assemblies Act was introduced by another Labor government, the Rann Labor government, the government of the day was concerned that through the 60s and 70s, governments and police had repressed protest in various ways. Attorney General Frank Walker was determined to introduce a regime that facilitated the right to peaceful assembly, not to restrict it. So that's an important backdrop. So until December last year, an organiser of a protest was able to notify the police and attain the status of an authorised protest. It was a fairly straightforward kind of procedure, and it enabled that group then to be exempt from some of the criminal laws that would otherwise be available to the police to regulate protest, and in particular, the offence of obstructing pedestrians or traffic. The regime allowed the police to object to the authorisation application by taking proceedings to the Supreme Court of New South Wales. The point of that is there was a regime in place that balanced competing considerations. It wasn't a free-for-all. We had an example of that last year when there was an application to protest and assemble at the Opera House. Mm-hmm. That matter went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court granted a prohibition order that the police sought. So that regime, I think, was a pretty reasonable balancing of competing considerations and interests.
We also saw, of course, the huge march across the Harbour Bridge in August last year. Initially, police tried to resist that, but it did proceed in the end with permission. And, you know, what, 90 to 100,000 people took part. It was peaceful. There were no arrests. That was under the old rules.
That's exactly right. And, in fact, it's a great case study in how this regime is supposed to work. In the wake of the tragic and awful events of Bondi Beach in December 2025, the New South Wales Parliament, at great haste, introduced a new regime which essentially allowed the police commissioner to declare that in certain designated areas, the police would no longer receive applications for achieving the status of an authorised protest. Now, it didn't ban protest. A protest could still exist, but it had to take a particular form, and specifically, it had to take the form of a static assembly. There was no capacity for that group to engage in a procession, engage in a march, mm-hmm. which is the most classic form of visual expression of political views in city streets. In addition, those December 2025 amendments broaden the availability of the move-on power. And when those powers were first introduced, Parliament was really clear they are not to be used against protesters. And yet one of the things we saw in December last year was that restriction was relaxed.
And then, of course, on the weekend, Luke, the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, he did go a step further, didn't he, by declaring this visit by the Israeli president a major event. Just to explain how that changed things.
Yeah, so this story goes back really into the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. So the government of the day and the parliament of the day introduced special measures that allowed the police to exclude people from certain areas, to have broader police powers in relation to events during the period that the Olympics was being run. And then in 2009, the government, I assume, decided, well, rather than have to pass legislation every time there's a big event in town, we will enact a generic major events act, which allowed for the closing down of parts of the city, the excluding of anyone, not just protesters, the expansion of police search powers and other move-on powers. And so, as the name suggests, one assumed that major events had a particular character in terms of scale, number of participants, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it came as a surprise when the government decided on the weekend to characterise the visit of the President of Israel as a major event.
All right, well, Luke, let's consider then whether or not the New South Wales government has gone too far, which you clearly think it has. Now, the Premier, Chris Minns, he says that restricting protests actually assists with cohesion, particularly at this time after this Bondi attack. And he really backs in these restrictions. Is there nothing in that?
At the heart of all of that, I think there is a genuine kind of emotional desire to offer some kind of support and empathy for the Jewish community in particular. I entirely understand that. But I think we really need to unpick what we mean by social cohesion. You know, I want to be sensitive about this because I don't for one minute underestimate the enormity of the distress and the loss and the grief experienced by members of the Jewish community in relation to events in Bondi last December. But our concept of social cohesion as a society, as a community, needs to be bigger and more resilient than responding to a particular incident at a point in time experienced by a particular community. Social cohesion needs to be about recognizing our diversity, our different views, our capacity to disagree. And if one embraces that richer conception of social cohesion, which is not, let's not offend anyone. That's not a realistic conception of social cohesion in a liberal democracy, in a culturally diverse liberal democracy. But if we mean by social cohesion the capacity of all of us to tolerate the expressions of our differences and our disagreements in an acceptable, civil way, then that's to be applauded. Now, I struggle to see how shackling the political expression of a particular group of protesters around a particular issue, I don't see how that fosters social cohesion. What it risks is greater alienation.